Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present David Swanson, campaign coordinator with RootsAction.org, who talks about what's at stake for the U.S. and the world in President Trump's move to decertify the International Iran Nuclear Weapons Agreement. Ana Portnoy, a Puerto Rico-based writer, poet, and performer, who discusses the status of post-Hurricane Maria relief efforts in Puerto Rico and mounting anger at the federal government for its slow and disorganized response. And activists Susan Dantino and Erica Raghavan Byrne, who explain why they oppose and protested a newly dedicated memorial honoring Christopher Columbus in Southington, Connecticut. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For the first time in 3 years, the Palestinian government, led by President Mahmoud Abbas, met in Gaza to settle the differences between Hamas and Fatah, whose leadership has been bitterly divided for a decade. The meeting, backed by Egypt and Saudi Arabia, was seen as a milestone for Palestinian unity. In recent months, the Abbas government has put increased pressure on Hamas in Gaza by rationing electric power to the territory. Hamas also faced reduced support from Qatar, a nation who is now the target of Saudi-led sanctions. Poverty and unemployment have been on the rise for some time in isolated Gaza. Security negotiations will begin soon in Cairo, which will include a discussion of opening the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt, which was closed in 2013. Negotiations will also focus on the future status of Hamas's 20,000-member militia, the Qassam Brigades. Hamas is blacklisted as a terrorist organization by the United States and the EU, complicating the formation of any unity government. ProPublica reports Texas first responders were disappointed with the performance of the American Red Cross in the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey. With less than a day's notice, the DeWitt County school superintendent was forced to run an emergency shelter in an unused district building to house 400 people. For the first 3 days that the shelter was open, only 2 Red Cross volunteers were assigned, and neither had any experience running a shelter. The American Red Cross has been on the receiving end of severe criticism for its response to recent natural disasters, such as Hurricane Katrina and Superstorm Sandy, where the organization was found to have diverted funds into a public relations self-promotion campaign. The Red Cross has a unique role among humanitarian groups since it has a government mandate to provide food and shelter during disasters. Despite criticism from Greater Houston officials, the Red Cross defends its response to Hurricane Harvey, declaring that it provided more than 400,000 emergency overnight shelter stays and served over 3 million meals. Houston City Councilor Dave Martin called the Red Cross the, quote, most inept, unorganized organization I've ever experienced. This came days after Martin ran into American Red Cross CEO Gail McGovern, who bragged about raising $2 billion after Hurricane Katrina and lamented that her organization would likely raise comparatively very little money after Harvey. Right-wing California Congressman Dana Rohrabacher met with Putin-linked Russian lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya during an April 2016 trip to Moscow. This development emerged as special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation indicates increased interest in a later meeting between Veselnitskaya, Donald Trump Jr., the president's son-in-law Jared Kushner, and former campaign chairman Paul Manafort in Trump Tower. During her meeting with Rohrabacher, the Russian lawyer gave Rohrabacher a copy of a documentary attacking the credibility of U.S. sanctions under the Magnitsky Act, which the congressman unsuccessfully attempted to screen before the House Foreign Affairs Committee. The Russian lawyer told a pro-Kremlin news outlet about her meeting with Rohrabacher, a key advocate of improved U.S.-Russian relations. The meeting focused on the Magnitsky Act, which sanctions individual Russians who were implicated in the death of a Russian lawyer who had been investigating the theft of $230 million from an American company owned by financier Bill Browder. A spokesman for Rohrabacher confirmed the meeting with Veselnitskaya during a congressional trip to Moscow. 3 months later, in the midst of the presidential campaign, The Kremlin-connected lawyer met with Donald Trump Jr., Kushner, and Manafort in New York, who had been led to believe that Veselnitskaya would hand over embarrassing information about Hillary Clinton. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Through his own words during the presidential campaign, and more recent remarks before the United Nations, Donald Trump is expected to take steps that could kill the international nuclear agreement with Iran, that some observers assert is the most important nuclear anti-proliferation pact this century. Trump has indicated he will decertify the agreement that President Obama and five other world powers negotiated with Iran in 2015. The deal, strongly opposed by Republicans, conservatives, and Israel, suspended Iran's nuclear weapons program and in return lifted internationally observed economic sanctions. If Trump decertifies the agreement, the issue moves to Congress, which opens a 60-day period for debate. If Congress votes to reimpose sanctions against Iran, it would effectively withdraw the U.S. from the nuclear agreement. While Trump says Iran violates the spirit of the agreement, the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency maintains that Iran is in compliance, a determination shared by the other signatories to the deal, Russia, China, France, Britain, and Germany. Trump's Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson have both indicated they support maintaining the agreement with Iran. Your reporter spoke with author and journalist David Swanson, who serves as campaign coordinator with RootsAction.org. Here he talks about his group's current campaign, opposing any congressional move to kill the International Iran Nuclear Weapons Agreement, and what's at stake if the agreement is terminated.
If you look for a consensus among those in power, even within the Trump administration, as well as the Congress, as well as the major media outlets and the academic political talking heads, I mean, there's a widespread consensus among U.S. nationalists that it's a good deal and should be stuck with and is one of the few things that's gone right in recent years, and there's no reason to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. But Trump apparently thinks that the national interest is whatever suits him personally, and that's a problem. But it's not clear what he's trying to do because, as you say, he's passing this to Congress. He's chosen not to refrain from waivers that he had to renew that, if he had not, would have created new sanctions in the form of renewing old sanctions on Iran. Rather, he's chosen to, as everyone is predicting, by the deadline of October 15th, announce that he decertifies the agreement. This is, of course, after months of the White House very openly seeking to find some way to claim that Iran was violating the agreement. And in the absence of that, Trump is simply going to announce that it's decertified. But that doesn't really change anything other than rhetoric. Congress, as you say, then has to decide whether it wants to impose new sanctions. From the point of view of people in Iran, the United States is, already failing to live up to its side of the bargain in terms of sanction relief. The question is whether yet more sanctions are going to be imposed, and whether this sort of rhetoric, substantive new sanctions, or other steps that have been announced, including Trump's intention to declare the Revolutionary Guard, the Iranian military, a terrorist organization, whether any of these things successfully provoke Iran to withdraw from the agreement or provoke Iran into launching a war, both of which seem to be the intention of numerous parties in Washington, D.C.
What's the motive here, do you think? Is this just a hollow campaign
commitment that Trump made while he was speaking before adoring crowds during the election campaign, that he was going to get rid of this quote-unquote embarrassing deal, this embarrassing agreement with Iran? Is this really what we're dealing with on that level?
I think that's a big part of it. And certainly the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, with whom Trump has now started a public insult match, believes that Trump is still living in a reality TV show, and he appears to be. And the fact that the United States Congress recognizes that and has not impeached him and removed him from office is extremely disturbing, at least to me, and I think it should be to everyone. But there are people in the Pentagon, high-level officials, who talk fairly openly, if anonymously, to journalists these days about the Cold War with Russia being motivated by weapons sales and by bureaucratic inertia and the, you know, the future of NATO and the future of the army. And if you look at Iran, the one thing that Iran is in the United States is incredible war propaganda. I mean, it's better than Russia. It's better than ISIS. A couple of years ago, Gallup did a poll, December 2013, in 65 nations. And in the vast majority of them, the answer to what is the greatest threat to peace on earth was the United States government. But in the United States, the answer was Iran. That is of high value to the biggest industry in Washington, D.C., and that is weapons making.
And David, looking down the road, if the Republican-controlled Congress does impose new sanctions on Iran and abrogates the U.S. Part in this nuclear weapons treaty, what is the danger for future tension and conflict between the United States and Iran?
The real danger, of course, is of war. And we're dealing with a White House that has a clear interest in war, is increasingly threatening war, even nuclear war, on North Korea, as well as Iran, as well as Venezuela and other parts of the world. And North Korea has nuclear weapons. Iran does not. And this, you know, the lesson that the world is going to learn is going to be disastrous if the United States attacks another country that has, you know, very publicly disarmed itself of any nuclear weapons, as was the case with Libya. But this is going to be a war to make Iraq and Afghanistan look like child's play. This is going to be horrific if the United States attacks Iran.
That was author and journalist David Swanson, who serves as the campaign coordinator with RootsAction.org. Learn more about the effort to preserve the International Iran Nuclear Agreement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Puerto Rico suffered the most damage from hurricanes this season than the island has witnessed in almost 100 years. Nearly 3 weeks after Hurricane Maria struck Puerto Rico, the island is struggling to recover. As of October 10th, 85% of Puerto Ricans are still without electricity. More than 40% don't have running water, and some 80% of cell phone service is out of commission. By some estimates, it may take 6 months or more to restore power and other basic services. The death toll in Puerto Rico attributed to Hurricane Maria has risen to 43, but officials say that number is likely to rise. Islanders continue to fall victim to storm-related hazards, including infections, dangerous road conditions, and lack of emergency medical care. The Trump administration has been condemned for its slow and disorganized response to Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, and now Trump faces more criticism for allowing a temporary waiver of the Jones Act to expire. Without a waiver of the Jones Act that permits only U.S. flagged ships to carry goods to American ports, Puerto Ricans will continue to face shortages of critical goods urgently needed for storm relief and recovery. Your reporter spoke with Ana Portnoy, a Puerto Rico-based writer, poet, and performer. Reached by spotty phone connection on the island, here she discusses the post-Hurricane Maria reality, the status of relief efforts, and the political impact of the disaster on the Puerto Rican people.
The metropolitan area of San Juan, which the U.S. and international media tend to focus on, is on a completely different plane than the rest of the island. communications are a lot more functional there. Provisions and aid have either reached communities or aren't as urgent as in towns outside of the metropolitan area. Fuels and supplies, supply attainment have reached levels closer to normalization. And overall, aid and relief have been made more available there, which speaks volumes about the metropolitan area and colonial intra-island dynamics. But for example, the central part of the island and the west side of the island, which is where I am currently, have been abandoned by both the central and federal government. It wasn't until recently that it was declared a disaster zone and therefore qualified for individual disaster assistance. And many communities are worried to the point of utter despair because no aid or relief has reached them yet, because they haven't seen any FEMA representatives, because they have no roof over their heads and FEMA hasn't delivered the tarps. People are rummaging through trash cans, walking miles to springs, creeks and rivers to bathe, to get water to drink, to take care of basic necessities. The situation is dire here.
There's been quite a bit of discussion since the mayor of San Juan had been very publicly critical of FEMA and the federal government's response to the hurricane disaster in Puerto Rico. From your understanding, what has been the weaknesses in FEMA's response and the other agencies of government, as well as the military, which has participated in relief efforts as well?
FEMA has been complaining a lot that roads haven't been cleared yet, while news reporters have been saying that roads have been cleared. And I'm not sure what difference that should make to FEMA, because with double helix helicopters specifically engineered to carry exorbitant amounts, why are they resorting to block roads as an excuse? I mean, the federal government can send helicopters and planes halfway across the world or further to the remotest parts of the planet to make drop-offs and deliver supplies to their military-occupying nations to advance the U.S.'s hegemony. But they can't tend to the humanitarian crisis on the island that JetBlue flies to and from 100 times a day because the roads are blocked. I mean, that just makes no sense to me. I'm not buying it, and many of us aren't. There have been a lot of problems with distribution efforts, and I think that has a lot to do with the state of emergency that was declared here, with bureaucratic holdups, with the Jones Act, the army here, the military in Puerto Rico. People from different communities and different sectors haven't been receiving any aid from them. It's more of a military occupation in a colonial sense.
I'm wondering what your neighbors think about the federal response in regard to the feeling of some in Puerto Rico that they perceive themselves as second-class citizens in the eyes of Washington. Is that something you've encountered?
Absolutely, and not just here in Puerto Rico, but stateside as well. Our diaspora feels the same exact way. We felt abandoned, and especially in non-metropolitan towns and municipalities in Puerto Rico, absolutely.
How will the destruction caused by these two hurricanes impact or affect people's views on politics in terms of the debate, the long-standing debate in Puerto Rico about commonwealth or statehood or independence?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's going to have a significant effect regarding public opinion on the federal government itself, on its efficiency or lack thereof. And hopefully this will eventually lead to discussions and conversations on Puerto Rico's political status. Because for the past 18 days, we, the people of Puerto Rico, have been taking whatever matters possible into our own hands. Communities, this involving our diaspora, have been at the heart of Puerto Rico's recovery. So disaster relief, aid, provisions, and groundwork have taken place at a micro community level with local efforts such as neighborhood brigades and watch efforts to keep the community informed by local AM radio stations. So once we register and internalize this amazing feat we've taken on alone, which is our survival, I think the possibility of a discussion on autonomy and hopefully on sovereignty and independence will arise and maybe become action. So I think this is an opportunity to push that political status conversation regarding independence and sovereignty.
That was Ana Portnoy, a Puerto Rico-based writer, poet, and performer. Find a link to her recent article titled Irma and Maria, Shedding Light on Puerto Rico's Colonial Reality and Related Reports by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. This year has seen dozens of cities in four states recognize the second Monday in October as Indigenous Peoples Day, replacing the nation's Columbus Day holiday. Columbus is being exposed more widely as a person undeserving of honor for his personal behavior toward the Indigenous peoples he encountered and for his larger role in the genocide of millions of people native to the Americas. This year has also seen more defacing of Columbus statues around the country. Bucking those trends, the town of Southington, Connecticut, unveiled a brand new bust of Columbus on October 9th, honoring him for, quote, discovering America. The statue was promoted and funded by Italian-American groups and the Knights of Columbus, a conservative Catholic organization. The town council of Southington voted unanimously to install the Columbus bust on public property in a prominent location in front of a municipal building. Dozens of people, mostly women, protested silently at the dedication ceremony, holding signs with quotes from Columbus's own diaries, revealing his racist, misogynist, and genocidal tendencies. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was there and spoke with Erica Rogoveen Byrne, co-founder of the group Southington Women for Progress, which led the opposition to locating the statue on public property. We also hear from Susan Dantino, a local Italian-American woman who came to protest the dedication of the Columbus Monument.
When we found out in July that the town council had approved and that a statue of Columbus was being put up on public property.
Unanimous,
and with very limited public input. We frankly were kind of shocked that that was going to be happening in 2017, especially given what we now know about Columbus and his actions and how they've impacted Indigenous people and African Americans through the slave trade. And so we first began with a petition asking that the statue not be put up on town land, that they started putting up the statue before we could present the petition to the town council. And so we've been working since then to try to mitigate some of the harm that can be done by putting the statue up of Columbus on public property.
It does seem a little anachronistic. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many other places are putting up statues of Columbus in 2017. Mm-hmm. But people know what they want to know, I guess, and I guess the word hasn't spread.
Yes, we definitely, there was a quote from a town council person in the newspaper saying, well, what we learned in school was that Columbus discovered America, and so that's what we learned. And it's like, yeah, but we keep learning, and we learn new information, and we also learn more about how it impacted people, and that maybe we didn't know that piece of it before.
So now the statue is here. I'm looking at it. It's got a little walkway. It's got lovely roses planted all around and American flags. And it looks pretty permanent. Mm-hmm. So what is your group's plan or hope for going forward?
What we're hoping is that we can either have the plaque on the statue itself corrected. The plaque says, or the inscription says, that Columbus discovered America on the inscription, which is historically inaccurate. We're also hoping that we can put together a committee of people to talk about putting a freestanding plaque up nearby that talks more about the complicated historical context of Columbus. We had hoped to come to some kind of agreement with the organizers, the committee that had put the statue together in the first place, but they declined to work with us on it. We also had requested to be able to participate in the dedication ceremony to present a fuller picture of Columbus, and they also denied that request. So that led to us participating here today. It is interesting that now we are kind of in this false equivalence world where we feel compelled to balance everything out, or that we're not telling the full story. I mean, he was an explorer. He came to the Caribbean. He certainly, to some degree, opened up the Caribbean and the Americas to exploration, though others probably would have done that if he hadn't. But the impact, the historical legacy of Columbus is, if you just read his own words in his journals, is just so horrific in a lot of ways. I mean, he bragged about being able to subjugate the natives that he encountered. He said they shall be good and intelligent servants. He talked about the price that he could get for women and children sold into slavery. And these were his own words.
That was Erica Roggeveen Byrne, co-founder of Southington Women for Progress. Italian-American Southington resident Susan Dantino was also there. She said her opposition was not an attack on people of Italian heritage who revere Columbus as one of them.
I believe that this is a national conversation that we need to be having. I believe that this is something that we all need to be participating in. And while we want to protect culture, we also want to protect the truth. And I believe that by his own admission, Columbus was participated in and led the annihilation of over 3 million indigenous people. And we believe that, you know, this is revisionist history. I'm a grandmother. I don't want my grandchildren learning lies. I want them to know the truth. And we really do support the truth. I believe, again, this is a national conversation that needs to happen, that we don't celebrate those people who, by their own admission, commit atrocities. If you want to erect a statue, then put it in a museum where it can be put into its historical context. I work with an organization for indigenous people for over, 15 years now. If I did not come out here today, I would really question those 15 years that I spent with an organization that supports our native people. That's Hawkwind. And we've done a lot of good in bringing to light the many atrocities suffered by our indigenous people. So I believe that that's the reason I'm here today.
That was Susan Dantino and Erica Roggeveen Byrne, opponents of a newly dedicated Columbus Monument in Southington, Connecticut. For more information on groups opposing the honoring of Columbus across the U.S., visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFA in Jamestown, New York, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, KEXP in Seattle, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.